Have you heard of the McComb Group? We're the PVF distributor contractors count on to keep projects moving. For decades, we've helped mechanical, industrial, and utility contractors tackle real-world challenges, providing unmatched expertise and one of the largest inventories of industry-leading products anywhere. And with our own logistics team on the road, your materials arrive when and where you need them. The McComb Group is here to keep you productive and moving forward. Call us today, online at McCombGroup.com. The McComb Group, built to say yes.
Jam-packed double helping of the Empire podcast this week, we say, do you see, to Lost Transmission star Simon Pegg, do you see, to Ride Like a Girl star Sam Neill, and do you see, Mandalorian, you are an insignificant speck of dust floating away on the galactic breeze, to the legendary Werner Herzog, blimey, all that and more on the movie podcast that lost out on an award this week. But don't feel sorry for us, because sometimes going without a trophy for a long period of time, say 30 years or so, makes the eventual winning even sweeter. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the award-losing Empire podcast. Congratulations, of course, go to History Extra for winning Podcast of the Year at the PPAs, the Oscars of the British publishing industry.
So is that not a Newman and Baddiel sketch?
That's what I thought. It's just a podcast where people are going, you see that Podcast of the Year award? That's you, that is.
Amon's too young, he won't remember it.
That's no. What that is. This was Newman and Baddiel, Amon. They were on the Mary Whitehouse Experience, and they were very funny.
I shall take your word for it, Chris.
Yes. Anyway, congratulations to History Extra. Unfortunately, now, as is the Conan way, I must crush my enemies, see them driven before me, and hear the lamentations of the women. And speaking of my enemies, this week I'm joined by three colleagues of such lethal cunning. As you've already heard, James Dyer is here by, air quote, popular, close air quotes, demand. Helen O'Hara is also here, the geek queen. Hello, how are you?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. With your brand new microphone, sounding all spick and span. Very exciting. And back in the fourth chair, the revolving fourth chair, is the best dressed man in film journalism, Amon Warman. How are you, sir?
I am well.
Good, good, good. How much sleep have we all had? I had 3 hours sleep.
Not a lot, actually. I'm pretty tired this morning. So this is going to be a sizzling conversation.
What are you doing? Wow. Why were you up so late?
I was watching Hamilton for part of it, which is very exciting, but we'll get onto that a little bit later. Yes, things to watch for podcasts primarily.
Okay, yeah. I was up editing a podcast until really, really late last night. Then I had to get up at 6 a.m. this morning to watch Hamilton. So that was a lot of fun. I'm still not entirely sure what's going on. I may actually be asleep. Who knows? But anyway, let's get on with the show. We got a lot to get through today. So, you know, guys, the other day I was walking down the street, respecting social distancing. Obviously, I had a mask on, of course, when a young street urchin came up to me and he said, please, sir, can you make sure that the much loved and respected film fact section is back this week?
It would make
ever so much a world of difference to the nation's morale and my general health.
Did you kick him?
You know what, guys? I ruffled that young scallywag's hair and I gave him a shiny sixpence. And I said, yes, young urchin. So here it is. The fact section is back. And this week it is known only as History Extra. And Jimbo, you are up first.
Oh, really? Must
yes,
I?
Yes, because I told you I didn't have any sleep, so I'm going to sleep now. I've set my alarm for an hour from now. You should be coming to the end.
Yeah. Okay. It's possible that last week's was a little excessive on runtime. I may have got some somewhat negative feedback on social media about this. So
did
I'm going to keep this one a little bit from people still in comas from having listened to it.
I cut stuff out of that.
Did you?
Yeah.
You absolute twat.
This part is going to be on DVD in time for Christmas.
The version integral will be out there. So what I have for you this week is a simple statement of fact, and it is this: Star Trek is at the center of all things. Mm-hmm. Specifically, the Borg are responsible for Donald Trump. Now, this is a fact that I actually have known for some time.
Already not a simple statement, but go ahead.
but Edward Llewellyn on Twitter reminded me of this fact, and I thought, you know what? That is an excellent thing that I can use to bore my quote-unquote friends with on the podcast tomorrow. So, cast your minds back to 2004. When the Republican senatorial candidate for Illinois was one Jack Ryan. No, not that one. But rather the ex-husband of Jerry Ryan, Star Trek Voyager's 7 of 9 and currently featuring in Star Trek Picard. Now, Seven and Jack had quite a messy divorce. And we all know you do not mess with an angry Borg. So Seven made her divorce records public, including an allegation from her that Jack Ryan, not that one, had pressured her to have public sex in a number of swingers clubs in several cities, asking her to assimilate with the collective, as it were. Now, this kind of summarily blew up the campaign of Jack Ryan, not that one, and he dropped out of the race, presumably to join the CIA. And in his place, the Republicans recruited a guy called Alan Keynes, who was rubbish and was soundly thrashed in the election by a young upstart named Barack Obama, who took that Senate seat from him and from there launched his presidential campaign. So we can thank the Borg for Barack Obama. So far, so good. However, as we all know, if Obama's presidency hadn't inflamed the racism of Donald Trump and his fragile ego hadn't been so bruised at that infamous White House Correspondents' Dinner, Trump would likely have never run for president. And so, in what is basically the plot of Star Trek First Contact, the Borg essentially have gone back in time and set us on a path for destruction and eventual assimilation, even if we did get Barry along the way. So resistance is indeed futile. That is my fact.
Yeah. I mean, she wasn't really acting on behalf of the Borg that we know, was she? Because she, like, doesn't act on behalf of the Borg.
Oh, like they announce these things, Helen.
I'm just saying.
That's why the Borg are so nefarious.
Ah, nefarious.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
Okay. Interesting. So you're working off the idea that Trump ran for office whenever he was singled out for criticism or jokes.
I mean, it's I don't know that anyone can definitively say that, but it's generally held
that's
belief.
Generally like, held, yeah.
In fact, you can almost pinpoint it down to a very specific event when he's lampooned at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And yes. John Lovett, who wrote the gags on that, has repeatedly taken responsibility for the Trump presidency because of those gags, because he was called out quite
publicly. Well, someone's got to take responsibility for the Trump presidency because they sure as shit aren't. Okay. That's interesting. But this was before she was in Voyager, right?
Back then? No.
94?
2004.
2004.
Okay. Sorry, they said 94. Blimey. No. Blimey, O'Reilly. Okay. Mm. Wowzers. Helen.
Hello. I was going to do the fact that I tabled last week in order to improv facts. So this is about the ability of film to change history, because I feel like we don't always credit it with enough power in that respect. And I think it is worth remembering that film can do very, very good things and also really, really, really bad things, as in the case I'm about to tell you about. Because we're back, I'm afraid, in the dawn of film in 1915 with D.W. Griffith's racist film, The Birth of a Nation. And The Birth of a Nation was an extraordinary film for its time in terms of filmmaking techniques, but it was hamstrung by the fact that it is the most racist thing in all a world of racists. So it was a film that actually goes out of its way and literally damages its own storytelling to glorify the Ku Klux Klan, who come in to this conflict to save apparently helpless white women from apparently rapacious black men, who, by the way, are also played by white people in blackface, just to make it even more offensive than it was already, which is saying something. At the time, in 1915, the Ku Klux Klan basically didn't exist. It had been suppressed under Ulysses S. Grant in the late 1870s, after its founding in 1865. By the mid-1870s, they'd basically been responsible for so many atrocities that Grant had sent troops to basically dismantle the Klan. So it was dead it was dead. And then this film based on the book, The Klansman by Thomas Dixon Jr., came out. It was apparently the first film ever shown at the White House to President Woodrow Wilson. So the story goes, although they're not apparently 100% sure that that was the very first, but certainly the first publicly announced film at the White House. And it actually inspired people, particularly a guy called William Joseph Simmons, to restart the Klan. So basically, he was recovering from a car accident. He heard about this nationwide success because obviously it wasn't day and date release at that time. So he was there in Georgia. So ahead of its sort of Georgia premiere, he basically got some guys together to burn a giant cross on a hill 10 days before the film premiered on a hill called Stone Mountain outside Atlanta, and basically announce the rebirth of the Klan. So that by the early 1920s, the Klan had over 5 million members in the US from zero when that film came out. So, basically, film can do bad things as well as good, and it's worth remembering the massive power that film can have. Obviously, that was one of the most successful films of its day. It's sort of like, you know, Avatar, but without any kind of criticism of empire or colonialism. The NAACP, by the way, had protested The Birth of a Nation throughout its existence. Black people all over the US, in fact, protested the film. And that was what they were worried about. They were worried about black people protesting against this racist film rather than the fact that the fucking Klan was reborn as a result of it. Anyway, that's the darkest fact I think we've had so far. You're welcome.
Well, I feel good. Thanks, Helen.
Yeah, this week it's a real chuckle fest, isn't it? You know, it's fucking hell, you're really both testing my powers of segue this week. really
sorry.
Amon, for the love of God, please tell me there's some levity in your fact.
A little bit.
Oh my God. There's a dog die.
I should point out that this fact does not contain
to
basketball.
Kill people. This fact has the power to kill.
Yes, that. No. No. There's not a thing about basketball in this fact.
I want basketball. Bring basketball back. Please, I beg of you. For the love of God.
But my fact begins at Disney in 1995 and concerns the casting on a little animated film called Hercules. So
everyone loves Disney. Disney never did anything bad or racist.
Is that true? No. But Michael Eisner had just taken over as Disney chief at the time, and he actually had his eye on Jack Nicholson to play Hades. So they courted him, and Nicholson was very, very interested. He went along to Disney's building in Glendale with his kids. They showed him some artwork. They actually also showed him some test work, which involved his lines from A Few Good Men set to animation. So somewhere in Disney's vaults, there's footage of an animated Hades saying, "Take caution in your tone, Commander. I'm a fair guy, but this fucking heat is driving me absolutely crazy."
Oh, we need that.
They need to release it. It'd be amazing. But that is not the fact. The fact is, Nicholson wanted to play the role, but he had some conditions, because for Batman in 1989, his contract to play the Joker also included profit points from not just the film, mm-hmm. but sequels. And he was looking for a similar deal for Hercules, including the merchandise receipts that Warner Brothers had given him in Batman, but Disney didn't want to play ball. And that is how Batman, being the goat that he is, scuppered the Joker's plans once more. and to bring it back to the tone of this podcast, apparently the role eventually did fall to James Woods, who, yes. You know, I do have to grudgingly admit that he's very good in the role, but as we all know, he's a Trump-loving ass in real life. So
and,
there
and
you go.
Thereby you continue the theme that I began and Helen continued.
Oh, gosh.
Sorry.
Bloody hell, guys. This is meant to get the podcast off to a good start. Instead, I feel weepy and maudlin. Oh, poor old Jerry Ryan. Her husband's a shitbag. What's going on there?
Yeah.
What an utter bin suit that gentleman is.
Yeah. Oh, and the second season of his show was really not as good as the first.
And don't get me started on the Sum of All Fears.
Don't knock the Sum of All Fears. It's great.
At least we have Clear and Present Danger. How dare you, sir? That's so good. So fucking good. All right. Okay. Jimbo, every week I look for a loophole in order to disqualify you. I think the loophole I'm going to find this week is that Jeri Ryan is predominantly a TV actor and not a film actor.
Oh my god.
Oh boy.
That's a low blow.
Trump.
No, here's okay, if you can name without googling in the next 20 seconds three films that Jeri Ryan has been in.
Three. Oh, come on.
Listen for the sounds of typing. Listen for the sounds of Googling.
Okay.
Let me think, what is Jeri Ryan's filmography?
No, Bosch is TV. Obviously, Star Trek Picard is TV. She's been in Arrow. That's TV. She was in Helix. That was TV.
You're not helping your case here.
I know. I think she was on Family Guy at one point. She's definitely... Oh, hang on. She was in... No. I was about to say she was in Mortal Kombat, but actually it was a TV series of Mortal Kombat.
Okay.
I've got absolutely nothing.
Oh. She was in Down with Love.
Oh, yes. Dracula 2000.
And
I'm now looking on the internet.
Dracula 2001. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Dracula 2000.
Down with Love.
Kids.
Yes.
Yeah. She was the stewardess.
There you go.
She was good in that.
Yes. But sadly, also, I think we all know where this is going. I have to go for the one that just didn't, you know, depress the hell out of me.
Which one was that?
It was Amon's.
Amon's was the least depressing.
There was no adultery. There was no Donald Trump.
I mean, it ended with Jack Nicholson.
Cheers. Oh, I know it ended with James Woods, but it had a bit of Jack Nicholson. And everyone loves a bit of Jack Nicholson. So for that reason, I'm going to give this week's point to the rotating fourth chair occupied this week by Amon Warman.
Woo!
Woo!
I will not woo. Fourth chair has really made a comeback in the last few weeks.
I think fourth chair has won the last 3 weeks in a row, I think, although shared a point with Helen on at least one of those occasions. Mm-hmm. Jimbo, I don't think, has won since his barnstorming Romeo and Juliet fact. So maybe, and I realize that I'm probably setting up a trap for myself here, but perhaps he needs to go back to his 20-minute theatrical productions.
No, I don't
think
so.
Sound effects and, you know...
It is. Next week, it's going to be the Stackhouse filibuster. I'm going to try and do an hour and a half flat and run out the clock, so you have to give it to me.
Is there any chance we could all have like 4DX chairs by next week, so that we can move left when you're moving left, and you know, whenever you're talking about wind and rain, there's, you know, water splashes in our face. That would be the story with me.
Yes. Yay for Team Fourth Chair. It must be nice. It must be nice to have Hewitt on your side.
Doesn't scan.
Unbelievable.
Come on.
Unbelievable. I was so close to being in the room where it happens and it all got fucked.
All right. Well, anyway, that is it for this week's fact section, aka History Extra. Time now for our first guest this week. I think... he's still a record holder for appearances in the podcast, but I can't be entirely sure. I think Tom Hiddleston might be running him close. Either way, it is Simon Pegg, and he is back this week in Lost Transmissions, which is a serious drama featuring perhaps his best, certainly his most serious performance yet, as a British record producer in the grip of paranoid delusions. Simon and I caught up over Squadcast earlier this week and talked about a whole bunch of stuff, including what he's doing in lockdown and his own struggles with mental health. Enjoy. Delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast, in lockdown, of course, because we're responsible that way, by the star of Lost Transmissions, Mr. Simon Pegg, making a triumphant return to the Empire podcast. How are you, sir?
It's good to be back. Feels like coming home.
Oh, it's good, isn't it? Feels warm, like, you know, retreating to the warmth of the womb.
It is. It's like a single slipper, like one of those mono slippers that you see in magazines on airplanes.
Like a nice pair of Mojabis, the slippers. Oh. I've always seen on Facebook, but I've never been able to afford, because they're like 90 quid or whatever. It's
£2,000 a shoe.
I think it's the diamonds that make them more comfortable ultimately. But
yeah, that does work. Yeah.
How you doing, man? You good?
Really good. Yeah, just you know, tootling along at home. Been doing a lot of writing, and that I found the whole lockdown situation to be fairly conducive to that, just because. I think if it wasn't for lockdown, I might be finding other things to do. And it's always hard to sit down, particularly with a blank page. But because if you don't do something with your mind in this situation, you're likely to go completely stir crazy. It's been a nice focus.
I guess you'd have been on mission by now, right?
I'd have been on mission. Yeah, we were all set to go to Venice. I was like literally 8 hours from traveling to Venice, and they called me and said, "Don't come just yet." And then by Wednesday, the following, that was a Saturday night, by Wednesday, it was like, we're shutting down. So it all happened really fast.
Bloody hell. So you were packed. You were packed and ready to...
Yeah, I was ready to go. I just got back from LA. I've been over there doing some pitching and then got home, was going to have one weekend at home and then say bye to the family and be gone for a month or whatever. And then suddenly here we are. And it's actually been nice because I've got to spend loads of time with the folks, which is important.
So, you know, have you been in touch with McHugh in this time? Has he used this lockdown because he reconfigured Fallout, didn't he?
Yeah, he was texting me speeches yesterday that were really cool. We stay in touch all the time. And, you know, I always, every now and again, I just think, I wonder how he is. And I'll text him and go, what's happening? And then I got a schedule the other week, which is a work of art and stretches for like 2 years or something. I don't know. I mean, he's a funny one, McHugh, because I think he actually thrives on making it up as he goes along slightly. You know, he likes to kind of like shoot the big set pieces and then by the seat of his pants, you know, create the narrative that links them all together and does it in a way that is just so effective. It's kind of, he's like an extreme writer.
The analogy he used with me is that he likes to, you know, is like leaping off a cliff with the parts of a plane and then ascending a plane in midair as you're plummeting. And I get the feeling that's actually how he writes. He just leaps off a cliff and literally tries to assemble a plane. And then he has the draft finished by the time he doesn't hit the ground.
Exactly. My eternal metaphor for working with McHugh is Gromit riding the train in the wrong trousers, putting the track down in front of it as it goes. You know, that's what it's like.
It's absolutely wild. So yeah. I've got to ask you, you're rocking a hell of a beard. It's very cool.
It's big, isn't it? Yeah.
Is this a Benji beard? Is he gone hipster?
I don't know. I had a look ready to go, which was a lot more neat. And then of course I just haven't bathed for I haven't self-groomed for however long it's been,
even down in the gentleman's area.
Oh no, I've kept my balls in check. No, I'll sit down in the makeup chair and say, what are you gonna do with this, you know, and see what they do. I quite like to have a big beard. I feel like Benji might be a bit, you know, morose after the last one because he had a bit of a hard time, so maybe he's just been sat in his pajamas.
He was so close. He came to the verge of death, to the point where I thought, oh my fucking God, they've killed him.
Yeah.
They've killed Peg. This isn't on.
I wanted there to be a lot longer of him on the floor. And I wanted Ilsa to like have to give him like, you know, CPR to get him to wake up so that the audience could go, no, please. we had stuff to do. The film was already 2.5 hours. The clock was ticking on those two nuclear bombs as well. It's not like really I had time to be revived. I had to get up and defuse the damn thing.
Yeah. So I can see that. Benji's had a near-death experience. Another one. But, you know, in this case, you know, he may even have died for a few seconds. Brought back to life, and he lets himself go a little bit in terms of the facial hair.
You know what? I don't want to wear a mask.
Yeah, fuck you, Ethan Hunt, and your rules about facial hair. I'm not going to conform anymore.
You'd expect every IMF agent really to be completely clean shaven because you've got to tear those things off so quick. No one ever goes ow when they take off a mask in Mission Impossible. It's always really smooth. It peels off.
That's a good point. The beard would be tricky. You couldn't get the mask on top of the beard, but bulge in the wrong areas.
I've never done any prosthetic work where you just peel it off at the end of the day and go, bye. It comes off real slow with lots of glue immobilizer and you're sat there going, ow, no, ow. That would be funny to see in Mission Impossible. A mask pull where the person goes, ow, that really, no.
What's the biggest prosthetics job you've ever had?
It was probably for Ready Player One when I was the old Ogden Morrow, because that was like a full head prosthetic and layers and, you know, and then a wig on top of that. And so that was about 5 hours. I got to work at, I think, 3 in the morning. and then sat in the makeup chair until 9 or something.
Bloody hell. And is it as bad as they say? I've never had anything like that done, thankfully.
It's kind of like, it's kind of nice in a weird way. As long as you go to sleep and they just fiddle with you and you're just sort of very passive.
Sure,
and
there's laws against that.
Yeah, I you have to stay fairly conscious in case they do fiddle. But it's kind of pleasant. It's getting it off is boring because you want to go home. You know, it's like the end of the day and then it takes another like 2 hours to get it off or whatever. But I don't envy. I mean, I remember the guys were just going off to do Gary Oldman for The Darkest Hour afterwards. And I think his schedule was like every morning like that for however long it was.
I mean, at some point you just go, look, we'll fix it in post, right? We'll just, you know, I'll wear the dots on my face. You'll just put it on afterwards. It'll be fine.
I mean, there's a chance it will get to that because, which would be a shame, but, the stuff they're doing now with, you know, to a greater or lesser degree of success with de-aging and stuff is kind of amazing.
It is. It really is. But then I guess Rick Baker's already retired. So I was going to say, what would he do? But he's hung up the old, prosthetics brush, but you know, it's a shame.
Someone like Greg Nicotero, who's you know, EPing a show like The Walking Dead or something, where there's loads and loads of stuff on the screen at once, loads of zombies. You've got to do that. You can't do all those digitally because it'll just cost a fortune. But I mean, in some cases, certain looks, I'm sure, will be, you know, purely digital. In Star Wars, in The Force Awakens, for me, which was a full prosthetic, but then they augmented the eyes to look less human, and or like Deep Roy in Star Trek when he plays Kienza, he has these little eye stalks that they put in afterwards. So there's ways to do it, and it's a mixture of the two, you know.
So I've been looking for a way for the last few minutes to segue into Lost Transmissions. I think I've got one.
Oh wow.
Because Lost Transmissions is a very serious film, and you are fantastic in it. But it's not a laugh a minute, Simon. So, I was trying to find a way to segue smoothly into it. And I think you don't wear prosthetics in Lost Transmissions. It is you. It is Peg au Naturel.
It's all me. Yes, correct.
One of the last times I interviewed you was in LA a couple of years ago for the magazine. Yeah. And you were in the middle of, I think you were just about to wrap on Lost Transmissions, but you were shooting it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You were telling me even then what a refreshing experience it was for you to shoot it.
I remember cause I had all the tattoos on my hand that Theo has, for the photo shoot. Cause you can see them when you look at that photo shoot, you can see my hands are covered in these little tattoos.
Oh really?
It was a really good experience. I really enjoyed it. I think that's, you know, because that was one of the first times I opened up, and it was the first time I ever opened up about my own sort of mental health issues. And it was because we've been making this movie and everyone had been talking about it. And even though it was a completely different set of circumstances for Theo in the movie, he's a schizophrenic. It was just the kind of dialogue was very alive. And so coming in and talking to you whilst making that film, I felt very sort of comfortable talking about stuff like that, which was great.
Actually, it's interesting because I remember being slightly taken aback by that because it was meant to be, it was a big interview. We had like an hour to have a chat and, you know, obviously you and I have spoken a number of times going way back.
Fair few.
And so I was, you know, we were setting off in a certain direction. And then I became gradually aware that we were steering into more serious territory, and that you were burying your soul, so to speak. It was really, really interesting to suddenly have to, you know, recalibrate and change the interview on the sort of in the blink of an eye.
Yeah, but like that trying to get onto Lost Transmissions after talking about geeky shit like masks and stuff.
Yeah,
it's the same gear change.
Segways don't come easily, do they? I mean, honestly, it's ridiculous. But it was really interesting. I mean, you know, and clearly, was it something that you've been thinking about, you know, in previous years? Because, for example, even on The World's End, which, you know, I think now looking back, especially looking at The World's End, it's like, oh wow, there's a lot of your own story in this. There's a lot of your own feelings in this, and in Gary King. But you weren't ready to talk about it in The World's End. So what really changed? Was it Lost Transmissions that changed everything?
I think so. And also just getting older, you know, I mean, The World's End was very much a kind of expression of some of those feelings for me. Hey, that's my 24 style phone ring coming out of there for the listeners. Yeah. So try and keep it out of the geek zone. I kind of, the playing Gary King was a real for me was quite a personal thing, and we really didn't want to take any of his issues as being part of the comedy. That was always going to be part of the drama of the film, and there's always a vein of drama in the films I make with Edgar. Mm. But I think, you know, getting down the line a little further and being a little older and not being so protective of my own sort of sense of self, I guess, you know, I used to be extremely nervous about anything personal, talking about anything personal, because I felt like, I don't know, it just made me paranoid. But I kind of loosened up, I think, a bit over the years and just thought, you know what, it's a conversation to be had. And the amount of people that contacted me after that interview came out and the subsequent one after that in The Guardian, people just saying, oh, you know, thanks for talking about that. I was utterly yeah. amazed by it. So I'm happy I did.
Because it must be a part of you as well, that even though you know that it will do you good to speak about it, it will do other people good to speak about it as well. There must be part of you thinks this may be something then that every cack-handed interviewer like Chris Hewitt will bring up in a cack-handed manner, in a really dreadful segue as well. So enough about makeup, Simon. Let's talk about mental health. it's going to happen in every interview from now on.
Yeah, well, I kind of the two things I was nervous about was I didn't want it to appear like I was doing one of those stories where someone is half trying to make out that they're a bit rock and roll. And I also, you know, knew that eventually it might come up again a few times, and it has done. And it does, and particularly when I'm promoting a film like Lost Transmissions, which is a film which directly addresses notions of mental health, it's a relevant question to ask as well. So, you know, it's okay. It's all fine. Mm.
Theo in the movie is, he's a schizophrenic, he comes off his medication, and he has several episodes, I think, maybe. I'm not sure if that's the way to describe them in the movie. You know, that's not your experience, though, is it? I mean, how much of it is you? How much of it was research talking to other people to get that right?
Yeah, it wasn't. I mean, it was a lot of research. One thing I did want to do was get it right. You know, I didn't want to wander into the film and just play crazy, which I think, you know, a lot of actors probably do when they get cast as someone with mental health issues, because they aren't discussed or kind of talked about. And there is this idea of crazy out there, which is a little bit romantic and a little bit kooky. And I wanted to understand what schizophrenia is as a condition. And I did a lot of research. I met with schizophrenics. I met the person who the film is based on, and we became friends. And I spoke to him a lot about his experiences and how he felt about his delusions at the time and how he feels about them now. I read a lot, watched a lot. And so, you know, because it wasn't anything within my realm of experience. Schizophrenics aren't sort of people with split personalities, which is what people tend to think schizophrenia is. It's mm-hmm. much more about kind of an overload of perception, which the brain tries to cope with and rationalize, but ends up making all these bizarre little narratives, which become paranoid delusions. And it was very, very interesting and very enlightening that to know that you can be a very ordinary functioning member of society and within a matter of days become someone who is standing on the street corner with no shoes on yelling at the sky. That happens a lot, you know, and people disappear into this realm of the insane and are suddenly devoid of any kind of humanity. People, they're just ignored, and you know, we use the insane category all the time in society to subtract people's credibility away. Politicians, particularly Trump, does it all the time. He'll call someone a wacko, or they use the notion of mental health as a way of sort of stripping away people's humanity. And that's kind of what our attitude towards mental health is in society. And that's not good.
Yeah, there's still a stigma about it. There's still a stigma, I think, about asking for help. There's still a stigma about saying I have a problem.
For everybody. And I mean, you know, and not to exclude anybody from this, because it's a completely universal problem. But as a middle-aged man, men have a lot of problems because they're constantly encouraged growing up to believe that you know, asking for help is a weakness, and or being weak is a bad thing. You know, accepting your own weakness is an admission of you know, not being good enough, and those things are programmed into us from a very early age. So a lot of men never ask for help, and there's a big statistic for, you know, guys of a certain age committing suicide because they're not getting the help they need.
There are moments in the movie, Theo goes to some very, very dark places. And it's you have accessed places like this before in your movies. You know, Sean, for example, you know, is in a very dark place by the end of that movie, very, very raw emotionally. But does this feel like your rawest performance? Does this feel like the one where you were most ready to tap into emotions like that?
Yeah, I was really happy that Catherine sort of thought of me. Catherine O'Brien, who's the writer-director, she sent me the script. And it came with a little note from my agents in LA saying, read this. And I was very happy that she'd sent it to me, just because that's not the kind of role I ordinarily get sent. You know, people kind of have an idea of what you do and what you can do, and they you come into mind for certain roles. And so it felt like, oh, this is a chance for me to actually do something other than, you know, other than be lighthearted, which is generally what I do. And it was, for that reason, really, really fun.
One of the things I think that stands out, that makes you stand out over the years as an actor, is you have a real, real naturalistic approach. You know, you can do more exaggerated styles of acting. You know, for example, those little bits of shorthand that you have with Edgar, you know, it's with St. Ivel's, all that sort of stuff.
Where you can
deliver a heightened style of acting. But, you know, even going back to the sketch stuff you did, it feels sometimes there's a very conversational approach to your acting. That feels very natural with you, feels very real.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, you're trying to create a truth when you're acting, and I suppose it's just about wanting to be as truthful as possible. I think when, you know, the show Big Train was all about the absurdity of mundanity. And a lot of the time it was very, very absurd situations played utterly real, documentary real. And so I guess I started out doing that kind of acting. And I just find it's always more convincing if you don't look like you're acting. Actors that I watch and maybe aren't a fan of, and there aren't many, but if I see an actor who I can see is acting, then maybe, although there are exceptions to that rule. There are actors like Jeff Goldblum, Anthony Hopkins, who you watch them and you know they're acting, but it's just so spellbindingly compelling. Mm. You know, I mean, Jeff Goldblum has a kind of ultra naturalism, which is just kind of breathtaking, and I love watching him act, and same with Anthony Hopkins, but they're past masters at what they do. They're actors who are so in control of their craft, you don't ever feel unsafe. When you watch an actor who's, you can see they're acting, it makes you a bit nervous because you think, oh, I'm not believing this. So it comes from, I guess, wanting to give the most authentic performance possible.
What's next for you, apart from waiting for the mission flag to drop and then off you go to the races?
Yeah, that's it. September 7th is the off date in Norway, and so I'm trusting that everything's in place to make that work safely. In the meantime, I'm just busy writing, and I can't wait to tell you what that's all about, because it's something I've been working on since 2012 on and off. And
oh, wow.
It's finally, hopefully, seeing the light of day.
Bloody hell! And you got Truth Seekers as well. That's
Truth Seekers is coming out in October. Yeah, that's our first sort of stolen picture show. That's Nick and Samson Keo in the lead roles, and that's going to be really fun. It's a very, very, it's got a lovely mood, that show. I can't wait for people to see it.
A nice mood, lovely mood.
Yeah.
Oh well, listen. On that note, I'll let you go, Simon. A pleasure as always. Thanks, man.
As do you, mate.
Cheers. Thank you. Okay, so that was Simon Pegg, and we will be talking about Lost Transmissions later on in the show. Next up, though, it is time for the listener question. This week, it's all about pubs. What with them reopening in the UK this week, see how that one goes. And a few people asked, principally the names I could find were at JW Colsey and at Mecha Lardzilla, about quite simply the best scenes set in pubs. Now, I think we may have done this before, but we're now 8 years into the podcast, so we might have to recycle some things at some point. And maybe there have been some films set in pubs since we last did this question. Also, just for an extra wrinkle and to give us an extra option for next week, I'm going to limit this to British pubs only. So no American bars.
No, fuck
Come
you.
On.
Pubs. On. The question
Absolutely
is very
not.
Specifically pubs. Well, what no, do you got for me? What do you got? On. What do you got?
Okay. I mean, I've had a long think about this, and many of mine are bars/saloons/cantinas.
I'm the same.
The occasional almost nightclub.
I will allow a cantina. Nightclubs are right out.
Wait, why are cantinas okay? They're even further away.
And that doesn't let us get Blade onto the podcast.
I can't. Well, when you say cantina, you mean basically just the cantina,
Mos Eisley,
right? Yes, the Mos Eisley cantina.
Yeah,
I'll allow
that. It's a space pub, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a space pub.
You will never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious.
Also, if you're saying pubs, then really you're limiting yourself exclusively to Irish theme pubs in any American film. So, you know.
Oh, but there's a good one. No, there's a good one in The Departed, isn't there?
I knew you were going to say that. An Irish theme pub.
The Departed.
We can't have bars. That rules out so many things. Desperado.
Rules out the whole second
half of Dusk Till Dawn.
It's very much a pub. It's definitely a pub, not a bar. It could be an inn. The Prancing Pony.
I knew. Yeah, that's a
and
pub.
The Prancing Pony is a pub. Those are both pubs. Yeah. So those.
As is the Three Broomsticks.
Yes. Or the Leaky Cauldron.
Well, you could go that way. Yeah. Or the Leaky Cauldron. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. There's obviously the Manners Maketh Man scene from Kingsman, which is always a lot of fun to watch. And one of the most used GIFs on Twitter is that Shaun of the Dead one with Simon Pegg. And Zuby Zelen when he lifts the that's a lot of fun. So that one, but yeah, you really limited me here, Chris. I had some good ones, man. I had They Came Together. I had X-Men First Class. I had Inglourious Basterds.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, that scene is so funny.
Well, Inglourious Basterds is, I think, also technically a pub.
It can be a pub. It's in the continental Europe, it's, like it can't be a pub.
It forms the same. It's not a bar. It has the feel of a British pub, but in France.
I love that we're getting pub-splained by someone who, I believe, has never literally walked into a pub in his adult life.
I have walked past one. I didn't like the look of it. I kept on walking. No, this is the thing. Like, you know, this is a question asked to Amon. I don't know what your drink status is, but I'm teetotal. You don't drink. So there's three teetotalers and James now and again will maybe sniff a glass of wine, but it sends him all kinds of squiffy. And then he's not able to focus on The Last of Us. All the characters go blurry. Oh no, I've killed Emily or whatever her name is.
What are you doing?
Oh no, a Scrabbler got me. Oh no.
Yes, the Scrabblers do give Emily a lot of jip in that game. It's very true.
I was even going to get animated on you, Chris. I had Beauty and the Beast, that amazing Gaston song was in there.
Oh, no, that's a pub.
All right, okay, fuck it.
Ink and Paint Club, Roger Rabbit.
You know what? I'm throwing up at the door. Saloons, bars, cantinas, fuck it, go for it.
Okay, then I'm saying the hands-down winner of bars is the very beginning of Terminator 2. I need your clothes, your boots, and your motorcycle.
Yeah, but that's definitely a bar. Like, that's a 100% bar.
I mean, it's clearly a bar. It's a biker bar. It's not even remotely a pub.
What's the name of the nightclub in Terminator? Is it
Tech Noir?
Tech Noir. What a fucking great name. I love that so much. Tech Noir. Because that kind of sums up Jim Cameron's whole approach,
doesn't
it? Absolutely
sums up the whole aesthetic of the film. Yeah.
It's amazing. And the music is so terrible.
I also watched Tangled for the first time last week. I know. And that has an awesome...
Yes. Is it the Rubber Ducky or something? What's it called?
I think you might be right.
Or
the Rubber Ducky sounds about right.
The Duckling or something. It's something like the Duckling, and then it's full of the most dangerous people in the entire world.
Yeah. I've got to say, Tangled is one of the most... You know, I hadn't seen that one until last week, and it had been hyped up by a lot of people. And I just thought it was good and not great, I've got to say. Yeah.
Oh,
I said
God.
It. At me if you must.
It's better than Frozen.
Helen, I'm surprised you haven't said a certain Marvel Cinematic Universe movie.
Which movie is set in the
pub? Well, the pub in the Blitz in London.
Correct.
First Avenger. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Okay,
fair
enough.
Yeah, and he goes back there after it's been bombed. Ugh.
And how does he get served?
I mean, I'm not sure he really does.
Okay, so here's the thing, right? He's sitting there at the table. So just for context here, this is Captain America, the First Avenger, everybody. And so Chris Evans as Helen's betrothed, Steve Rogers, is he's at the table drinking by himself because his best mate, Bucky, fell off a train. Oh no, Bucky's dead. And so he's very, very sad and he's drowning his sorrows. But here's the thing, his metabolism is so fast, he can't get drunk. But, you know, if he switches up to heroin, who knows what might happen after that.
Probably bad things, though.
You think, Captain?
Yeah, I think I don't feel like heroin. I don't feel like I'm on too much of a limb to say that might be bad.
A coked up Captain America, that'll be interesting. So how is he getting the drink? Presumably, he's reached behind the bar and nicked some bottles.
Pulled it himself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Are we tracking this behavior? Are we tracking this behavior, Helen?
You don't know he didn't leave money. He could have left money.
He could have. We didn't
don't
see it.
Don't even start with me and Tony's parents
it's
again.
A straight
don't
line
even. We've had
from
this discussion.
Reaching behind a bar. Oh, this place is bombed out. No one really minds if I just take this bottle of booze. It's a straight line from that to oh, no one really minds if I will just hide the truth about the death of Tony's parents from Tony. Oh,
James,
and
should
that.
We give Helen and Chris the room?
Anyway,
this is the room where this happens. I don't know what
hashtag Team Tony. Hashtag Team Tony. Any other MCU pub scenes?
I mean, again, they're mostly bars after that. I feel like, you know, you've got Luis in the bar where the barman is Stan Lee. But that's definitely a bar, not a pub.
I'm a fan of the tangential Marvel Wolverine trying to recruit Wolverine in the bar scene.
Oh, yes.
Where Magneto and Professor X, fuck off. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, but there is a pub in First Class. Where Professor X, is hitting on the girl with the non-matching eyes. It's a very groovy mutation.
Oh, I didn't mean that scene. I meant the scene where, I think it's more of a bar, where Fassbender's Magneto sort of...
Yeah, that's a bar.
Takes his revenge on a couple people.
On the Nazis, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great scene. That's probably the best scene in that movie. It's fantastic. The Frankenstein's monster music cue by Henry Jackman is a cracker. There are people screaming at their podcast devices right now because there are some there are ones we just haven't. We've mentioned Shaun of the Dead, right? But we haven't mentioned Hot Fuzz or The World's End, both of which...
No, there are no pubs in The World's End.
That's right.
a common misconception.
All right, here's another quick sidebar. We're doing another side quest while we're in talking about gaming parlance. So Emily has just killed one of the Scrabblers, and now she has to go off and get a ladder so she can rescue Josh from the evil people, all right? So this is what we have to do. Can you name all 12 pubs in The World's End?
The World's End, there's one.
Yeah.
Is it the two dogs? Is there a two dog? Something like that?
Two-headed dog.
Two-headed
dog. The tech noir, the prancing pony. The
green dragon.
The titty twister.
Yeah.
How many can you name?
I've just did.
I mean, that's it.
Really? That's it?
Yes. Absolutely.
I just burned them all and put them on a t-shirt like you did.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't put them on a t-shirt. I was given a t-shirt that had them on it.
But, okay,
I don't study that t-shirt like the Grail Diary. It's not. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I absolutely do that. Okay, I'm going to give it a go. Hole in the Wall and then The World's End. Right, okay. So other people are going to be shouting at us about, so far, the omission of With Nell and I, which has that, many pub scenes, obviously, but it has the amazing scene where I, Marwood, goes into the toilet and sees the graffiti that says, "I fuck arses." And he has the voiceover goes, "I fuck arses. Who fucks arses?" And then how can we not mention The Slaughtered Lamb?
I mean,
it is my local.
Is it?
No, though it is in Surrey. It's called the Black Swan, I believe, and it's not far from Guildford, as I recall correctly.
Really?
Ah.
Yes, bloody indeed.
See, why was that in your film facts section? You might have won.
Yeah, I should have done that. I very much enjoy the saloon sequence at the end of Unforgiven. I'm just not sure it has a name. It's just a saloon. You know, that I killed just about anything that walked or crawled at one time or another.
I keep trying to think of more like British films, like older British films, pub scenes. So things like Passport to Pimlico definitely has a knees up down the pub when they reopen because they've basically found a loophole in rationing. It was the whole sort of idea of that film. But other than that, I'm really just sticking, and I know I'm missing out on lots.
I'm not great on names, but I know there's pub scenes in Get Carter.
There must be pub scenes in Whiskey Galore. I mean, by definition, almost there must be pub scenes in Whiskey Galore. So I feel like, and while we're in Scotland, Begbie throwing the glass in Trainspotting. Cool. Mm-hmm. That's a great pub scene.
Yeah. That's a great pub scene.
If we can broaden the definition to include tea houses, I very much enjoy the Z Zhang fight in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Which is great.
It's broadening the definition beyond any reasonable range, surely.
I don't know. As people who don't generally drink, I would have thought a tea house is very much more our jam.
Oh, it's massively more our jam, especially if it serves jam and, you know, scones. But I just...
Any cake shop scenes you'd like to talk about?
That's amazing.
Oh my God, the whole of Marie Antoinette.
I just thought of another MCU bar pub scene in Far From Home when Jake Gyllenhaal has that big speech revealing that
The revelation.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah,
that is a kind of themed, like, isn't it like a German themed?
Oh, is it? He's in Prague,
isn't it? Oh, yeah. Fine. But so it has that kind of...
It has a vibe going on. Yeah. It feels almost like
Only other sort of bar / pub scenes I keep thinking of are sort of American. So I think of Django Unchained and that sort of great scene where they have to sort of call their sheriff to meet Schultz and Django in the bar. That's great. I think of The Magnificent Seven, the most recent one, with Denzel sort of entering the bar and just commanding every eye in the room and then taking out the bad guy. It's awesome.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, again, you could throw a rock at a Western and hit a great saloon sequence. You know, I've mentioned Top Secret in this podcast before, which is perhaps the only film in the world to have an underwater fight in a bar. So if you haven't seen that before, it's absolutely
amazing.
It's wild. But for me, guys, it's, you know, the Winchester, and it comes down to the Winchester, and it comes down to the slaughtered lamb, you know, which has, you know, what's that star on the wall? And that incredible, you know, "You made me miss" line from David Schofield.
Daredevil.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's referenced in Daredevil, precisely. So it's weird to
hear the word Winchester and not have it be associated with supernatural.
I know, right? So bizarre. I mean, but if there was a problem, you would go to the Winchesters and wait for it all to blow over. That would be a solid, solid plan. So.
Surprised no one mentioned Cocktail.
That's a bar. Can't be a pub. By definition, it's a bar. I've opened it up.
Obviously, I've opened it up.
So confused now.
I've opened it up to include restaurants, theatres, anywhere you have a bit of live performance. King's Place in London, where we do our live podcast, that would also be acceptable.
You've opened it up to include pubs, bars, and basically everywhere, much like the UK government.
Hey.
So I have to ask of the four teetotalers in this virtual room, are we all going to get shit-faced this weekend? What are you going to do?
First time ever.
Yes.
I am planning to do some work this weekend. YOLO. I might go for a picnic though, so.
Fair enough. And so we're not going to pubs. I'm not sure I'm going to pubs ever again, if I'm honest with you. I didn't much go to them beforehand, but now I have even less incentive. Yeah, pint of COVID-19, please, barkeep. And it's really difficult to drink through the mask.
Really difficult to drink through the mask. So few of them have attached straws. So,
although Baines genuinely does, so that could work out quite well.
Well, he has one of those bendy straws that goes out of his mask.
I think there's all those little pipes on the front. One of them bends down and he can just dip it into his drink.
It's like a still suit.
I'm Weatherspoon's reckoning.
You merely adopted the Weatherspoons. I was born in the darkness. Anyway, that is it for our listener question. I'm sure we missed off loads and loads of pubs. I'm sure you were shouting at the podcast device of your choice. Do write in and tell us, correct us where we went wrong, or if we missed out anything egregious, any horrible, glaring oversights, then do write in and let us know. But if you want to have your question read out in the Emperor podcast, as the aforementioned, what the hell are their names? The aforementioned, I've lost it. Where's the question? Here it is. The aforementioned at JW Colsey and Mecha Lardzilla did Tudor Cost. You can get in touch with us via, well, basically only one method at the moment. It's Twitter. Just wait for me to send out a panicked shout every Thursday. That helps. Or you can slide into my DMs or just send in questions using the hashtag Empire Podcast, because there we will see Lowe's. That is for sure. Right, time for one more guest before we bring this to a halt, and it is another ruddy legend making a return to the podcast. Ride Like a Girl is the true story of Michelle Payne, an Australian jockey who defied the odds and a horribly sexist industry to win a big horsey race. I don't have the full details of what the race is called.
Melbourne Cup.
Trust me, that'll do. That's the one. The big horsey race, mate. She's played in the movie by Teresa Palmer, and her father, Paddy Payne, sounds like a bookmaker, isn't, is played by Sam Neill, a man whose constant stream of songs, wisdom, warmth, kindness, and daft short films on Twitter and Instagram have done so much to ease spirits during lockdown. So naturally, I jumped at the chance to have Sam back in the pod, even though he's in Australia and I had to get up really early to do this. And did I ask him about Event Horizon? What do you think? Enjoy.
Technological faff today, but there we go.
All right. Sam, which would you want to do first, podcast or magazine? I'm going to go podcast. I'll go podcast today. All right, I'll give you a big introduction and away we will go. Delighted to be joined on the Emperor Podcast in lockdown, of course, because we're responsible that way, by a man who is keeping us all sane during lockdown, the great Sam Neill.
Hi, Chris.
How are things?
Things are fine. I've actually been out of lockdown for a couple of weeks. We're sort of moving around in a sort of gingerly fashion, gingerly, is that a word? And being careful, of course. But life is returning to some sort of semi-normality here, I suppose, of some kind. Nothing's ever going to be quite the same. But you know, restaurants are open and these sort of things. So. One isn't quite as, that dreaded isolation that people are finding so difficult, understandably, seems to have gone for a while. But now we're having a spike. I'm in Australia at the moment, and there's a spike in infections in Victoria that no one quite understands. And so it's time for super caution again, and we'll see how all that pans out, you know.
Well, fingers crossed. One of the things that has been good about lockdown, if I can use that word, has been your creativity and the way that you have taken it upon yourself to produce short films with a little bit of Sam Neill nudity thrown in there for good measure. What was that about, Sam?
Yeah, we've got two more in the works, and it's been fun to actually. The next one is actually outside of my apartment, and I went up and stayed with my friends Brian Brown and Rachel Ward, and we made a little film together. Actually on location, quarantine films are actually on location with three actors in the same room at the same time. So it's almost like making a real film again instead of by remote. No, but that's all been fun, and stopped me from going completely barking mad on my own here and in my apartment. You know,
I can't imagine what it's like. I mean, I'm in lockdown with my wife, and so I've been okay in that regard for the last few months. But I can't imagine what it's like to be in a room with someone else. You know, at the moment I'm watching movies, and if someone touches someone else, I'm like, this is beautiful. This is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Even if it's just a simple handshake,
it is extraordinary when you're watching films and you think, Why are those people sitting so close together? And, oh, my God, they're going to kiss. What, do you remember when people used to kiss? I just watched Will Ferrell's film last night, they kiss at the end. You know, it's sort of COVID-safe all the way through, and they nearly kiss, and then right at the end they kiss. Applause from my sofa, you know.
So these short films that you've been making, Sam, have been a delight, as well as the ukulele sessions and the poems. And I love the way you start each video with just a simple how are you? Because it's nice to care.
Yeah, well, I realized early on how we were walking with such rapidity into an unknown future, and no one quite knew what everything meant, how serious stuff was. No one knew the consequences of anything, and people just seemed so afraid and frightened, but more than anything, alone. And I just think that's one of the best things that you can say to people is how are you? You know, how are you? And one of the sort of unrecognized problems that goes with all this is actually mental health as much as anything. And now we're getting more attuned to what mental health means. And that simple question, how are you, is really has been sort of weirdly underrated for such a long time. It's so important, isn't it? You know, it's so important. I love it when people say, how are you? I mean, really, how are you?
Yeah. This is not a criticism, Sam. Okay.
I'm bracing.
Has this reinforced for you the importance of a director?
Of course it is. But that's always been the mission of Cinema Quarantina, is that it should have bad continuity. Hugh, who's the editor, has to make the mess the best of a mess, you know, and we should never really be on the same page. That's the point of it. Yeah, they're just a farrago, really.
Has it been tough getting into the character of Sam Neill?
Do you think there's a continuum of a character in there? Is it the sort of beaten down guy who gets easily bullied by his own phone? Yeah, that's probably the real me. It's sort of leaking out in a sense.
Cinema is truth. And Cinema Quarantino is truth. Quarantino as well. But talk of directors, Sam, brings me, because I'm the king of segues, smooth segues. I should do this for a living, to Ride Like a Girl. Because in this, you're directed by the great actor Rachel Griffiths, who's making her directorial debut with this.
I have to say, she's one of the most interesting directors I've worked with, because actors can give other actors notes that you don't get from other people. You know, I love being directed, actually, going back to your earlier question. I think it's a great gift when you're going into character. And oftentimes when you've been around as long as I have, which is about three lifetimes on the screen, you turn up and directors sort of assume that they, you know what you're doing. Well, you sort of know, but it's really their story that you're serving. And I love getting, you know, the best possible direction is when someone says, that was great, but let's try it a different way, or let's flip it on its head and see what happens. And Rachel was very good at that.
It strikes me, having spoken to you over the years a number of times, but it strikes me that you're a very prepared actor. And so you turn up the set and you know how you're going to play a scene or a moment. Is that true? And if it is true, is it easy for you to roll with the punches in such a way?
What I've learned is that you shouldn't be over prepared, actually. And, you know, you need to learn your lines. You need to understand what the scene is. But if you're not leaving any room for the moment, for the possibility of some kind of spontaneity, and you're not prepared to be, because being prepared doesn't prepare you for being in the room with the other actor. And that's critical. And what the other actor's giving you, that to and fro thing is something you can't and shouldn't prepare for. That happens on the day. And when it happens good, it's great.
Another thing as well about Ride Like a Girl, which is interesting, is that you are playing a real person. You're playing Patty Payne, the real Patty Payne. And I there's a lovely featurette that's on YouTube where you actually meet Patty, you know, and you spend a little bit of time with him. Was that important to you to get a sense of the man?
I had a whole day with him. I think probably what isn't included in that little bit of footage is when we were just having a chat, and he looked me up and down and he said, "I've never seen any of your movies, mate, but they tell me you go pretty good." that's okay with it. Yeah, you do have a responsibility when you're playing real people not to make a goose out of them, you know. And he's a man I admire a lot. He brought up, was it 9 children? I always forget. But
10, yeah. I think.
10, is it? Is it?
Okay. Yeah, 10. Yeah.
Happy to be corrected on that one, but an awful lot of children. And his wife died when the little ones were very small. So a lot of that child raising was pretty much single-handed. And that's a big enough achievement in itself. But he was, of course, a wonderful horse trainer, understands horses like the back of his hand. I mean, it was a great day to spend with him. We just walked the track and talked about horses. I come from a bit of a horsey family myself, so to be able to I just love time. I love spending time with people who really know what they're talking about, anything, but with horses. Horses are so mysterious. They're so peculiar, you know, and who knows what's going on in a horse's head. But someone like Patty that's been working with them for, I don't know, 60 years or something, it's marvelous to have that kind of, some of that knowledge permeate across to you, you know.
Are you comfortable in horses, Sam, then, if you come from a horsey background, so to speak?
I love being on horseback. I'm very comfortable with that. It's one of the great pleasures of life, I think, is going out for a ride. But this is probably the horsiest film I've ever made, but I never get to ride in it, ironically. My parents were very, they always had horses. They were very horsey people. I didn't particularly like horses. I'd had to learn to ride for a film for my brilliant career, which was at the start of my career pretty much. And so I had to learn for that. And in the course of learning to ride, I realized what an idiot I was. It was so invigorating and marvelous to be on horseback.
So, and it's useful as well. It's one of those actor's skills on your CV or your resume that you haven't lied about.
Yeah, really useful. And you're absolutely right. Almost every actor puts on their thing, you know, plays cricket, rides horses, you know, can joust, almost all of which are completely fictitious. And you find yourself alongside an actor who clearly hasn't been on a horse before and is going to fall at any moment. But, yeah, I counted it up once, and last time I counted it was something like 10 films that I'd had to actually write in. So, yeah, it's a very useful skill.
So Paddy tells you that he has never seen you in any movies, and he may not know you from Adam Sam, which is frankly a disgrace, but we'll let him off. So say, for example, that you're putting together a 3-film box set of Sam Neill's career to give to Paddy to catch him up. To get him up to speed in your career, what films are you choosing?
Oh my god, that's such a strange question.
thank you.
Well, I might give him Cry in the Dark, because I was playing a real character in that, also known as Evil Angels, a film about the Chamberlains, directed by Fred Skepsy, which notoriously. Became, you know, and a dingoes took my baby, because I was playing a real character, I was playing a real person then, and I felt a great responsibility in that particular film, because in my view, these poor people had been done a grave injustice, and I still feel that way. And poor Michael, who's died now, I wanted to make sure he didn't look like a goose. Mm. What else might I put up? Dean Spanley, because that's an animal film, and I played a dog in it. What would be the third? Let's do Hunt for the Wilder People, because it's a New Zealand film. Paddy, of course, is a New Zealander, and he'd be familiar with a lot of that territory, and indeed with a lot of those characters. You know, he'd know them well.
That is a cracking triple bill, by the way. Although I feel I have to censure you a little bit on your omission of Event Horizon, because Sam, I can
film people really love that film. They really, it's just, I don't know what it is. What the hell? You know, you think some things just die. They're never seen again. And that film is just, you cannot kill it. What the hell is it? I don't get it.
It's a strange one because it's having a renaissance. It's having a real renaissance of late. But Sam, I have been on the Event Horizon train since the beginning. That movie gave me and my university flatmates nightmares for 2 weeks straight. We became obsessed with that film, with it. And I mentioned it pretty much every single week on the Empire podcast, much to the chagrin of my co-hosts and listeners. But it means I cannot let you go on this podcast without asking you at least one tangential Event Horizon question. So we had Jason Isaacs on the show a couple weeks ago, and I had been made aware that he had, for the Event Horizon wrap party, made all his fellow cast members a collage of pictures from the movie. So my question is twofold. Do you still have that? Do you remember it?
I remember it, but I don't have it. It's good. It got buried somewhere. I do remember that, though.
You're not a sentimentalist?
No.
You wanted to bury Event Horizon as far away from you as it possibly could.
I enjoyed making that film a lot. If I have one criticism of it, I thought I thought the suspense had gone. The suspense that we shot, it was cut I didn't like the editing. I just thought, you know how in Alien, it's sort of the suspense is about what you don't see, and it's about waiting for something to happen. But I thought they kind of lost that somehow in the edit with Event Horizon, and it sort of goes at a kind of breakneck speed, and that's the one thing that I regret about it. But I enjoyed making it a lot. There was only one moment that was difficult for me. We were all in spacesuits, and I can't remember what the scene was, but I suddenly got claustrophobia. It's the only time it ever happened to me on a set. And I had to rip off my space helmet because I just couldn't. I couldn't breathe. I don't know what the hell happened, but it was a really frightening moment. Yeah, and the nudity was, of course, terribly difficult. I end up as this sort of monster with and my genitalia have been cut out. So I had, we shot that over maybe 10 days, 2 weeks. And I would come in at, I think, 2 a.m, and I'd go into makeup and they'd cover me with all this stuff. And I'd be ready by 10. So it was 8 hours in makeup, 8 hours. And then they'd cover me with blood and then they'd take me over to the Bond stage, which is enormous. It's the size of Heathrow. And it's midwinter. I was freezing cold. And they had a one-bar heater. And there's me naked, extremely vulnerable. They'd have a one-bar heater. And I could sort of warm my front. Oh, my back was freezing cold. But then all the blood would dry up. So and I turn around and they respray me on this side. I get my warm. It was hellish. But every second day I'd get off, you know, just to recover. And then I'd come in for the same ordeal again. And it's very hard to know where you're moving into when you're playing someone who's turned into something absolutely demonic. There's nothing in one's life to prepare you for that, you know. If you're a horse trainer and you've been around horses, you know a little bit about what you're going to do. But turning into a demon is whole uncharted territory. It's very, very scary.
Yes, I can imagine it is. The last thing I wanted to ask you before I let you go is, in light of the Jason Isaacs rap gift, what is your rap gift game? Are you generous, or do you just buy a chop lot of mugs for your fellow cast and crew and let that be the end of it?
Well, if I like them, if they're particularly fortunate, I'll give them some of my wine. That's as high as honor, an honor as one can possibly expect. Yeah.
And do you charge them a half price? Is it a generous rate?
It's a generous gift. Yeah. Very fortunate.
Well, Sam Neill, as always, it's been an absolute pleasure. A man who has, in the middle of this lockdown, he's already got Horse Rider on his CV, but he can now play ukulele. He can now play Bruno Mars and ukulele. He can read poetry, and he can cook a duck l'orange. Well, maybe not quite that, but it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much. Chris. And that is Sam Neill, and that is it for part one of this week's bumper jam-packed two-part podcast. Join us in part two when we'll be discussing the week's movie news, reviewing a little film called Hamilton? Is that right? Am I getting that right? And some other films that have the misfortune of not being that particular film. And, of course, talking to Werner Bloody Herzog. See you on the other side, Mandalorian. Bye.